central heating, but he won't take it off because he doesn't want to show his paunch.
What about your father?
He asks. Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home, and when he died, all he left us was alone.
The Temptations.
It's a good song.
You're not taking me seriously.
You've asked me this stuff before.
And you haven't answered.
Recognise the pattern? Leaning back in my chair, I rub the instep of one foot with the arch of the other. I'm not wearing shoes or socks, preferring bare feet because I like to feel the ground beneath me. My electronic tracker looks like a manacle minus the ball and chain. I tested it once. I made it as far as the parking area before the alarm started sounding.
I want what's best for you,
says Guthrie, giving me his hangdog look. Then let me go.
Answer my questions.
Isn't my silence loud enough, I think. Don't tell me that my silence doesn't have a sound. I can hear it, loud and clear, screaming between my words. Guthrie sighs and scratches at a razor burn on his neck, lowering his eyes to look at my file. He's going bald in a neat round dome on top of his skull. Does it happen to all men? I quickly draw up a mental list. Alfie and Dylan from the kitchens have full heads of hair. Paddy the gardener is a little bald, and Reno, one of the councillors, shaves and oils his head, so it's hard to tell. Terry Boland had hair, which fell out after he'd been dead a few weeks, which isn't the same. Some do, some don't, is my guess. Guthrie has been talking to me. He lectures more than talks. His voice is so boring he should make meditation tapes. Soporific is my word for the day. Every morning I choose a new one from the dictionary and try to put it into a sentence. Certain words stick in my mind like peripatetic and serendipitous because they sound so musical. Others I've forgotten already. When my mind wanders, the walls seem to drop away, and the streets and houses and cities disappear, until I find myself lying in the shade of a tree, smelling the grass and turned earth and wood smoke. Nearby, my mother is moving between the rows, filling a wicker basket with raspberries and red currants. I don't know if this is a real memory, or if someone has planted it in my mind to make me believe that I had a childhood, but I can remember the soft golden light and the buzz of bumblebees in the hedgerows, and the coarseness of the grass. I remember my mother's dark hair, which curled over her shoulder as she worked. Guthrie's voice intrudes.
What would you do if you could leave?
Get a job? Find somewhere to live?
I could help make that happen.
Good.
We could process the paperwork today. All I need is a few details.
He clicks the top of a pen.
Firstly, your date of birth and your real name and where you were born.
I sigh as though I'm dealing with a moron. Guthrie continues.
How do you know you're 18?
You've checked my teeth and my wrist bones. You've taken x-rays and measurements.
Those tests have a margin for error.
I'm in the margin.
How did you meet Terry Boland?
I don't answer.
Did he kidnap you?
More silence. I toy with the cord of my track pants, twirling it between my fingertips. There's no point getting annoyed or acting the way I feel, which is bored shitless, because I'll get another red card. Can I have a drink of water? I ask.
No.
I'm thirsty.
Not until you answer the question. I'm trying to help you, Evie. But we have to meet each other halfway.
Halfway to where, I think. People always say that when they have no idea of the distances involved. I could come from another planet. I could come from another time in history. But they want to meet me halfway. I'm happy with who I am. I have pieced myself together from the half-broken things. I have learned how to hide, how to run, how to keep safe. Despite never knowing a time when my blood didn't run cold at the sound of footsteps stopping outside my door, or the sound of someone breathing on the opposite side of a wall. I know the jittery, crawling sensation that ripples down my spine whenever I feel the weight of eyes upon me, searching my face, trying to recognize me. And no matter how many times I step into doorways or look over my shoulder or yell, "I know you're there," the street is always empty. No footsteps, no shadows, no eyes.
"I understand your pain," says Guthrie. "I know how it separates you from a normal life, from what's true and real."
How does anyone know what's true or real? Things we once accepted as fact are now accepted as being wrong. The Earth is not flat. Smoking isn't good for us. Pluto isn't a planet. Witches weren't burnt at the stake in Salem. And humans have more than 5 senses. Everything has a half-life. Even facts. Guthrie rocks back in his chair and looks at me impatiently. He begins quoting from my file, which he seems to know by heart. The foster homes, my escapes and arrests, the alcohol and drug abuse. I interrupt him. "Why are you so determined to keep me here? You don't even like me."
"Yes, I do."
"You're frightened of me."
"No."
"Really? How is your wife? Has she asked you for a divorce yet?"
"That's none of your business."
"Are you seeing a counsellor?"
"No."
"Liar. Are you having an affair?"
"No."
"Is she?"
"Of course not."
"She is."
"Shut up, Evie."
"Is he an old boyfriend or someone new? Someone she met at work? A colleague?"
"That's a red card."
"I overheard you talking to Davina. You told her that you didn't want your wife going back to work, but you couldn't afford the mortgage on a single wage. You said her boss was a sleazebag. Is he the one?"
"Please stop,"
groans Guthrie. "Let me go."
"You're not ready."
"Who is that man who came to see me today?"
"A psychologist."
"What did he want?"
"He came to look at you."
"Why?"
"I think he can help you."
"Can he get me out of here?"
"Maybe."
I know he's telling the truth, but not the whole truth. The idea makes me shake with dread and excitement. "Is he coming back?"
"I hope so."
"I do too. But I say nothing."
Chapter 7. Two photographs of Jodie Sheehan dominate the front page of the Nottingham Post. One shows her dressed in her school uniform, with her hair neatly brushed, and the barest hint of makeup. Jodie is smiling cheekily at the camera, as though someone behind the photographer has made her laugh. The second image captures her in motion on the ice in a costume that sparkles with sequins. "Ice Princess" is the banner headline, above a subheading, "Missing Jodie, 15, found dead." Further below is a breathless commentary describing the discovery of Jodie's body and the search for clues. As expected, she is portrayed as a fairy tale victim, Little Red Riding Hood snatched from a lonely footpath by a crazed beast who had been lying in wait for her. There are quotes from neighbours, school friends and fellow skaters, all of whom are shocked and saddened. "I can't believe it could happen here. This is such a nice area. We look out for each other. Who would do such a terrible thing?" I often wonder how people can live in such a state of innocence. Then again, what is the alternative? Fear? Suspicion? A siege mentality? Inside, there are 2 more pages of photographs, some showing lines of police searching the meadow, or the crowds of onlookers in the glowing white tent amid the trees. This is just the beginning. Certain crimes generate their own energy, like bushfires racing across treetops, moving faster than the wind, sucking oxygen from every other story. They consume the news cycle until they burn out, or some other tragedy takes their place. Angel Face had been like that. Overnight, Guthrie had sent me the files on Evie Cormack. There are thousands of pages, admission records, ward notes, psychiatric assessments, escapes and offences. I begin by familiarising myself with the original case, pulling up the earliest newspaper stories about the discovery of Terry Boland's body. He was murdered in a house in Hotham Road, in East Barnet, where his body lay undiscovered for 2 months until neighbours complained about the smell and the landlord was summoned. Police broke down the door and found a mound of rotting flesh tied to a chair. Fingerprints were impossible given the state of decomposition, and whoever killed Boland had cleaned the house so thoroughly, bleaching floors, vacuuming rugs and wiping down every surface, that only one set of prints remained, which didn't show up on any police database until Angel Face was printed 6 weeks later. It took facial recognition technology to reveal the victim's identity. A computer-generated photograph was released to the media and triggered a call from a woman in Ipswich who identified Terry Boland as her ex-husband, an unemployed truck driver, aged 48, born in Watford, twice married, twice divorced, with a history of petty crime and low-level violence. Two Alsatians were found in a kennel in the rear garden of the house. The animals were in surprisingly good condition, given how long Boland had been dead. Clearly, someone had been feeding them, which generated the theory that the killer, or killers, might have returned to the house, showing more compassion for the dogs than for the man they killed. When details of the torture were leaked, the murder took on a greater sense of urgency. Various theories emerged, including foreign crime syndicates, or money laundering, or a drug deal gone wrong. Without any new leads to feed the story, the media became more interested in the fate of the dogs, which were given names, William and Harry. The Sun and Daily Mirror ran competing campaigns to find them new homes. Hundreds of readers offered to adopt the animals, while others donated money, until the Alsatians risked becoming the richest dogs in England, before the deputy mayor of Barnet Council stepped forward and adopted them, promising to use the donated funds to build an animal shelter. In the weeks that followed, the story slipped from the headlines, until Angel Face was discovered and it became an international news event. A mysterious child in a secret room. It sounded more like a Grimm's fairy tale than reality. Among the files that Guthrie has sent to me is the original admission form from Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital. Gender, female. Name, unknown. DOB, unknown. Height, 50 inches. Weight, 57 pounds. Condition, underweight, filthy, evidence of scabies, head lice and rickets. Physical signs of long-term sexual abuse, including deep perineal and vaginal lacerations and scar tissue. Markings, birthmark on her left inner forearm the size of a penny. Scar on her right thigh, 4 inches above the knee. Multiple lesions on her back and chest, most likely caused by cigarette burns. Property, 8 pieces of coloured glass, a large tortoiseshell button. Clothing, soiled jeans, a woolen jumper with a polar bear on the chest, cotton knickers. The admitting officer is listed as Special Constable Sasha Hopewell. She was photographed carrying Angel Face into the hospital, an image that flashed around the world and became synonymous with the case. I call it up on my computer. Constable Hopewell is dressed in dark gym gear, leggings and a jacket and trainers. Her knees and elbows are smudged with some sort of white powder. The girl in her arms looks filthy and emaciated, her hair a tangle of snakes, her face gaunt. She's dressed in the clothes described in the hospital admission form. Sasha Hopewell was 22 when she found Evie. She'd be 28 now. A lot of people become special constables as a stepping stone towards a full-time career in policing. Sasha could still work for the Met. I want to ask her how she found Evie, what made her go back to the house so long after the murder. I call Barnet Police Station in North London and negotiate a maze of automated choices before reaching a desk sergeant. "Never heard of her," he says, wanting to get rid of me. "She was the officer who found Angel Face." "Oh, her. She doesn't work here anymore." "Where can I find her?" "No idea. She was only a volunteer."
"She was a special constable."
"Yeah, same thing."
I hang up and type Sasha's name into Google, hoping she might have a Facebook page or Twitter account, but come up with nothing. Instead, I stumble across several newspaper photographs of her leaving a house identified as being in Wembley Park, possibly her parents' place. She is surrounded by photographers and reporters, forcing her way grimly through the pack. Further down the screen, I find a story from the Harrow Times. Sasha's father, Rodney, is quoted asking the media to leave his daughter alone.
She's not allowed to speak to you. She doesn't have anything to say. Please let Sasha have her life back. A street name is mentioned. I try the reverse phone directories, but the family's number is unlisted. Eventually, I call an old friend who works for the DVLA. Donna Forbes was a year ahead of me at school and is one of the good ones.
How do I know you're not trying to trace an old girlfriend?
She asks. I'm not.
Yes, but how do I know?
I'm trying to find the special constable who found Angel Face. You remember the case?
Of course, why her? I'm going to assume it's police business,
says Donna, sucking air through her teeth.
But if I get caught, I could lose my job.
I can hear her typing in the background.
Every search creates a data trail.
More typing.
There's a Rodney Hopewell in Wembley Park.
She gives me an address and phone number. I owe you a drink, I say.
I expect dinner.
You're married.
A girl still has to eat.
Rodney Hopewell answers on the fourth ring. A gruff-sounding man, he recites the phone number before saying,
Could I help you?
Is Sasha there? There is a pause.
Who are you?
A friend. The phone goes dead. I don't know if he hung up or the line dropped out. I call again. The number rings off. I try one more time. Someone picks up the receiver and drops it into the cradle. I'm listening to dead air. Chapter 8. The major incident room at West Bridgeford Police Station has a makeshift feel, as if put together in a hurry. Computer cables snake haphazardly across the floor, and desks are pulled into clusters. A series of whiteboards dominate the space, covered with data collected over the past 24 hours, crime scene photographs, timelines, and phone wheels. Some of the information is highlighted or circled with fluorescent markers or linked by hand-drawn lines, creating a storyboard of Jodie Sheehan's final hours. 40 detectives are working on the case, collecting CCTV footage, knocking on doors, and taking statements. Many of them have been up all night, and their eyes sting with tiredness and too much caffeine. Most are men. Lenny has done her best to get more women into the CID, but politics and sexism trickle down from the top. Regardless of the difficulties, she rarely complains, although she has become more outspoken with age. Professionally and publicly, she enforces laws that she sometimes regards as being antiquated and unfair, protecting property rather than people, while privately she rails against the real causes of crime: poverty, boredom, stupidity, and greed. None of these are excuses. In Lenny's view, deprivation doesn't force someone to put a needle into his or her vein, or gamble away a welfare check, or put a rubbish bin through a shop window, or set fire to a homeless man. Every society gets the criminals it deserves, is her philosophy, and the police force it's willing to pay for, rather than the one it insists upon. The 10 o'clock briefing is underway. Lenny is perched on a desk with her feet on a chair, listening as various detectives bring her up to speed. Some I've met before. Many have nicknames. Monroe gets called Marilyn, for obvious reasons, although she does have blonde hair. Her partner is known as Prime Time, because he manages to get himself on camera so often. My personal favourite is David Curran, a sharply dressed younger detective they call Nobody, because nobody's perfect. An estimated 2,000 people were at the fireworks display on Monday, with as many as 300 vehicles. Parking was ticketed, but anyone could walk from the surrounding streets and set up a picnic blanket for the show. There were no CCTV cameras focused on the crowd, but the rugby club had one in the parking area and another covered the traffic lights on Clifton Lane. A detective sergeant with a crew cut consults a laptop. 22 names have come up on the sex offenders register, living within 3 miles of the murder scene. We've spoken to 8 of them and we'll get to the others today.
Any of them known to Jodie?
Asks Lenny.
Kevin Stokes lives 3 doors away. He served 7 years for molesting 2 boys at a swimming centre in Coventry. The victims were 5 and 7.
When was that?
He was released 8 years ago.
Anything since?
Nah, he's on a disability pension, needs a mobility scooter to get around.
check with his doctor, says Lenny, turning to another detective. Where are you with the family?
Primetime licks his finger and flips a page of his notebook.
Dougal Sheehan is a cabbie. He says he left home at 7 and did a 12-hour shift, but it's proven difficult to track down his movements. We're going to look at his logbooks and credit card machine. The uncle, Brian Whittaker, teaches at the National Ice Centre. He's a recovering alcoholic who briefly lost his coaching licence 8 years ago following a complaint about inappropriate behaviour from one of his students. The allegations were withdrawn.
What sort of complaint?
She accused him of taking pictures of her in the showers. He denied it.
Were there photographs?
None were found.
Talk to the girl.
Lenny turns to Monroe.
What about Jodie's brother, Felix?
He was at the fireworks early in the evening but left with friends before 8. He says they went to a nightclub where he picked up a girl around midnight and went back to her place. He can't remember the address or her name.
Convenient, mutters Nobody.
He seemed pretty cut up about what happened to Jodie,
says the constable I saw outside the Sheehan's house last night.
You talked to him?
Asks Lenny.
Yes, Gov, but he didn't say much. I'd call him strong and silent, but it's more like brooding and sulky.
Did you clock his car? Says Edgar. A top-of-the-range Lexus? Business must be good.
Find out what business,
says Lenny, before turning to Nobody.
Where are you with Jodie's phone?
Mobile puts her at the fireworks until about 8 o'clock, but it stopped transmitting at 8:12. I figure she must have turned it off.
Lenny looks at him askance.
Do you have kids, Nobody?
No, Gov.
For future reference, should you ever find a woman who wants to give birth to a little Nobody, you'll discover that teenagers can't go 5 minutes without their phones. Jodie wouldn't have turned it off without a very good reason.
Maybe it ran out of juice,
suggests Monroe.
Perhaps,
says Lenny, clearly not convinced.
Find out what sort of phone she was using. She might have had tracking software, or some app that allows us to turn it on remotely.
Yes, Gov.
When and where did we lose the signal?
A fish and chip shop called the Inn Place on South Church Drive.
Talk to the staff. See if anyone remembers her. Where are we with her call log and text messages?
We're waiting on her service provider to release them, says Edgar.
And her laptop?
Nothing out of the ordinary in her search history. Apart from the fact that she wiped it regularly. Mostly it was homework assignments, music videos, clothes, makeup, etc. We're still trying to access her iCloud account, but these tech companies treat every request like it's an attack on civil liberties.
That's because we're fascists, grunts Primetime.
The deep state,
says Monroe. Lenny gets to her feet, hitching her houndstooth trousers and running her hands through her hair.
Okay. I want interviews with everybody who had contact with Jodie on Monday evening, and that includes friends, neighbours, secret admirers. Also look at anyone who follows her on social media and who comments on her posts.
She divides the task force into 4 teams, each with a senior officer in charge. One group will concentrate on the door-to-door interviews, another will trace Jodie's movements, a third will track down known sex offenders in the area, and the fourth will search for anyone seen talking to Jodie at the fireworks. The briefing ends, and detectives disperse, some pulling coats from backs of the chairs and heading out. I get a nod from Lenny. She wants to talk to me privately. Closing her office door, she sits in her high back chair and opens a desk drawer, pulling out a scented candle, which she lights with a match, filling the room with the chemical reek of lemons.
My personal trainer suggested them,
she says.
Apparently they relieve stress. I think they mask the smell.
Of what?
40 detectives, fast food and too much caffeine.
I notice a wedding gift register open on her laptop.
My sister is getting married again,
she explains.
You'd think after 2 husbands she'd be gun-shy, but she's having all the bells and whistles. A horse-drawn carriage, white wedding gown and a reception in a manor house. The whole family has to show up and watch her pledge her undying love for some guy she met on a Caribbean cruise in August.
Third time's a charm.
He's a sodding dentist.
Lenny closes her laptop and moves away from her desk, pressing her back against the window frame.
You got anything for me?
Not yet.
What does your gut tell you?
Strangely, my colon hasn't said a word since this morning.
Lenny nods, as if to say, point taken.
Despite our closeness, Lenny has never fully embraced psychology as being a science, and criminal profiling is an important tool. She's not a complete Philistine, but regards it more like a dark art akin to psychic readings or ESP. Lenny doesn't try to understand the moral insanity of a perpetrator or put herself in his or her shoes. She doesn't want to look at the world through a criminal's eyes or imagine their torment or sympathise with their motives because it might interfere with catching them and locking them away. Psychologists care about motive, as do juries and actors and people who've lost someone to suicide. For a homicide detective, that which moves and that which impels is never as important as the action itself. Fuck the why, Lenny would say. Tell me the what, where, how, and who. Her arms are folded. She waits.
Jodie was a low-risk victim for her attacker, I say. She was young and small for her age, which made her easier to subdue. The attack site was also low risk, a quiet footpath, deserted at that time of night. Jodie wasn't expected to be there, so most likely he's an opportunist, unless they arranged to meet earlier. More likely it was unplanned. She was hit from behind and subdued quickly. He didn't bring anything to bind her and made little attempt to clean up afterwards.
He tried to hide her body.
With a few branches, a token gesture. He may have panicked or something spooked him. I think he's inexperienced, disorganised. He didn't plan the rape. He didn't plan the murder. There's a knock on the door.
Got something, boss? Says Edgar.
He leads us back to the incident room, where two detectives are going through CCTV footage collected from cameras in Clifton on Monday evening. Chairs are pushed back to give Lenny room. I watch over her shoulder. Edgar presses the play button. The footage shows a deserted footpath outside a row of shops that includes a nail salon, convenience store, hairdressing salon, carpet cleaning company, and the fish and chip shop. A group of four teenagers comes into view, a girl and three boys. Two of them are drinking from cans of beer. The girl is wearing tight jeans, boots, and a puffer jacket. Jodie Sheehan. The tallest of the boys puts his arm around Jodie's shoulders, and she shrugs it away, knocking the lager from his grasp. He glares at her angrily and picks up the foaming can, shaking spilled beer from his hand. He runs to catch up with the others, disappearing from view.
"This is 14 minutes later," says Edgar,
as he fast-forwards through the street cam footage. Jodie walks back into the frame, seemingly alone. She stands beneath the streetlight and reapplies her lipstick, using her mobile phone as a mirror.
"Is she waiting for someone?"
asks Lenny, leaning closer to the screen. At that moment, Jodie looks up and waves to someone out of shot. A few seconds later, she steps off the curb and disappears from view.
"That's all of it,"
says Edgar, pressing pause. I look at the time code at the bottom of the screen, 2048.
"What time did Jodie's phone stop transmitting?" I ask.
2012, says Edgar.
"If her mobile was turned off at 2012, how is she still using a phone under the streetlight 15 minutes later?"
"She had a second phone," exclaims Lenny.
I tap Edgar on the shoulder and ask him to play the footage again.
"Slow it down."
Jodie is under the streetlight. She waves. She steps off the curb.
"There!"
I point to the screen. None of them reacts.
"Her shadow changes. It doesn't just lengthen, it moves from left to right. I think a car was doing a U-turn."
"He's right," says Lenny. "Someone picked her up."
Chapter 9. A buzzer sounds. The door unlocks. Each new section of Langford Hall has added cameras and extra staff, but most of the security is understated or invisible. There are louvered observation panels and tamper-proof locks on the doors. The windows are made of plexiglass and the bathroom mirrors are plastic. Nothing can be unscrewed, unhooked, unhinged, or rendered into a weapon or a noose. Evie's room has a single bed,
a desk, and a wardrobe that is divided between hanging space and drawers. There are pictures of dogs on every smooth surface. Cut from magazines and glued closely together, they form a collage of mismatched sizes, shapes, and breeds. A poodle looks bigger than a Great Dane. A beagle seems to be balancing on a Jack Russell's nose. A dictionary sits open on Evie's desk. Pages are marked, words underlined. Nearby, a worn set of playing cards is fanned out, face down, as though waiting for someone to pick a card. Unlike Jodie Sheehan's bedroom, Evie has no posters of sporting heroes, or pop stars, or photographs of her friends. "Can I sit down?" I ask. Evie shrugs ambivalently. I turn the only chair towards the bed, where Evie has her back against the headboard and her legs stretched out. Her hair is gathered into a wet ponytail on one side of her neck, and she's wearing so much makeup that her eyelashes look heavy to lift. She clicks a ballpoint pen open and closed with her thumb. "You like dogs?" I say, glancing at the walls.
"Is that a question?"
"An observation."
"Well done, Sherlock."
"How long have you been here?" I ask.
"This admission, 10 months, 4 days and 11 hours.
"What was your index offence?"
"You know that already."
"I wanted to hear it from you."
"I broke someone's jaw with a half brick."
"Why?"
"He stole my money."
"You think he deserved it?"
"Yep."
Her eyes narrow, and she looks at me dismissively.
"I know what you're trying to do. You want me to feel sorry for him. You think if I show remorse, I won't do it again. That if people steal from me or hurt me, I won't take it lying down."
Evie pulls up her legs and hugs them with her forearms. "What do you most want, Evie?"
"I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want,"
she says, musically, singing a Spice Girls song before riffing into Prince.
"I want to be your lover. I want to turn you on, turn you out, all night long, make you shout."
I interrupt her before she goes on. "What would you do if you were allowed to leave here?"
"Anything I damn well please. I wouldn't have to deal with social workers or people like you. No offence."
"None taken." Reaching across the bed, she picks up a bottle of nail polish and unscrews the lid. Pulling her right foot into her lap, she begins painting her toenails with small, delicate strokes. Purple.
"Are you going to give me a psych test? I'm very good at them."
She licks an imaginary pencil and prepares to take notes.
"When you see a sick or sad person, can you put yourself in that person's place?"
Her accent is Swedish.
"A. Not at all. B. Just a little. C. Somewhat. D. Moderately. E. Quite a lot. F. All the time."
I don't answer her. She carries on.
"Do you believe others control how you think and feel? A. Not at all. B. Just a little. C. Somewhat. D. Moderately. E. Quite a lot. F. All the fucking time."
I interrupt her. "Have you done many psych tests?"
"Dozens."
"Why is that, do you think?"
"People think I'm crazy."
"Why?"
"You tell me, you have a shrink. You're here to poke the bear with a stick, see if I bite."
"Do you enjoy shocking people?"
"Yeah."
"Why?"
"It's so easy."
Evie tucks her imaginary pencil behind her ear.
"Are you an ex-junkie?"
"What makes you ask?"
"A lot of the caseworkers here are former addicts. Why do you think that is?"
"Maybe they understand addiction." She points to my wrist, where my shirt cuff has ridden up, revealing the edges of a tattoo.
"Some people get tattoos to hide the needle tracks."
"Not me."
"Do you smoke dope?"
"Not anymore."
"Why did you stop?"
"It was a crutch."
"That's very honest of you. And boring."
"Do I bore you?"
"This place does."
"Is that why you tell lies and take off your clothes and disrupt group therapy sessions?"
"Not really. Maybe. I have my wheel."
"What's that?"
My hamster wheel. Everybody needs one in a place like this. It keeps you sane.
What's yours?
I stopped caring.
I don't believe that's true.
Seat yourself.
Evie pulls up her foot and blows on her toes. Do you have any friends here? I ask.
No.
Why not?
Some of them are okay. Nathan and Cleary have been to prison and tried to big themselves up, hoping the girls might sleep with them, but no bed hopping is allowed.
Would you like to bed hop? She raises one eyebrow.
Are you suggesting I'm promiscuous?
I'm asking if you have a boyfriend.
Maybe I fancy girls. You shouldn't assume. I once kissed Charlotte Morris with tongues, but that was for a dare.
Was Charlotte a friend?
Not really. She went home. They all go home eventually.
Except for you. Evie shrugs, and I can see a timeless humanity in her. What about foster parents? I ask.
I've had loads.
What happened?
They sent me back.
All of them?
Sometimes I ran away.
Tell me about the last family who fostered you.
You mean Martha and Graham? They were hippies, vegan. They treated their herbalist like he was a brain surgeon and kept blaming my behaviour on my diet, wanting me to eat weird shit.
Is that why you ran away? She pauses and thinks.
I don't know. Maybe.
Where did you go?
Edinburgh.
You were 6 weeks on your own.
And I would have been fine if they'd left me alone.
You were arrested for gambling. I glance at a deck of cards on her table. Do you like playing cards?
I'm good at it.
It doesn't come across as bragging. You were quite tough on Serena the other day.
She was lying.
You don't know that?
Yes, I do.
Evie looks up from painting her nails, the brush poised above her big toe. Wet strands of hair have escaped from her ponytail.
Can I call you Cyrus?
Sure.
If you'll permit me to say this, Cyrus, I don't think it's fair for someone like you to be studying me and not to tell me why.
You think I'm studying you?
Yes.
Evie screws the lid onto the nail polish and points her toes towards me.
What do you think?
Nice.
I have pretty feet. Don't you agree, Cyrus?
She stretches out her legs, resting her feet in my lap. This time, when she points her toes, they press against my groin.
Are you one of those guys who get off on women's feet?
No. I lift her legs and put them back on the bed. Evie smiles.
Definitely not gay. Are you married?
No.
Do you have a girlfriend?
I hesitate before answering. Yes. Says Evie, as though not convinced.
What's her name?
Claire.
Do you live together?
She's working overseas.
When is she coming back?
I'm not sure.
Evie
says again. I'm annoyed at myself. Guthrie has me spooked. Is that why I'm being so truthful? Technically, Claire and I are still together, by which I mean we haven't broken up, although our Skype calls have gone from daily to weekly and lately once a month. She's in Austin at the moment, working on appeals for death row inmates on behalf of the Texas Defenders Service. It was supposed to be a 6-month assignment, which has stretched to 10 months. Initially, we had planned to spend this Christmas together in New York, but Claire told me 2 weeks ago that she has to work through the holidays. I offered to come to Austin. She told me I'd have more fun at home. What were the dogs called? I ask. Evie hesitates.
What dogs?
The Alsatians that you kept alive in the garden. The newspapers called them William and Harry, but you must have had names for them. Fear ignites in Evie's eyes. She's not used to people knowing about her background.
You can't tell anyone who I am,
she says, glancing anxiously at the door.
It's against the law.
I know, I give her a moment to relax.
Sid and Nancy,
she says, referring to the dogs. Did you name them?
No.
Terry must have liked the Sex Pistols.
I guess.
Why didn't you let the dogs loose? You were sneaking out at night to steal food for them. You could have set them free. Evie has gone quiet. Someone shouts along the corridor. A voice answers. A third person tells them to shut up. I think you wanted their company, I say. Sid and Nancy were your friends. I can almost see the wheels turning in Evie's mind. She's steeling herself for the next question, the obvious one, the most offensive one. Why didn't she run when she had the chance? I won't ask it, because it would imply that she was somehow complicit, that she was responsible for what happened, when nothing could be further from the truth. I know the answer already. Elizabeth Smart, J.C. Dugard, Sean Hornbeck, Natasha Kampusch, all victims of celebrated kidnappings, all of whom had opportunities to escape but chose to stay with their abductors out of misplaced loyalty and love, or a learned helplessness. The same was true for Evie. She was drawn into a binding, dysfunctional, yet compassionate relationship with her abuser. She was brainwashed using the classic methods of sensory deprivation, threats, violence, and kindness. He created a new normal for Evie, convincing her that her parents were dead or had abandoned her, or that others wanted to kill her and only he, Terry Boland, could keep her safe. Did you stay in touch with Sasha Hopewell? I ask.
Who?
The officer who found you. Evie shrugs, pretending not to remember her name. How did she find you? I ask.
She got lucky.
I think she was very clever. Evie pulls a face. That famous photograph, the one where she's carrying you into the hospital, she had white powder on her knees and elbows. You had white powder on your bare feet. It bugged me for a while. Then I realized it was talc. I think she suspected you were hiding somewhere in the house, so she waited until dark and she sprinkled baby powder over the floors. The next morning she saw your footprints, up the stairs, across the landing, into the wardrobe. That's pretty clever, don't you think? Nothing from Evie. Tradesmen were renovating the house. It was up for sale. What did you think was going to happen?
I would have found somewhere else to hide,
she replies, making it sound obvious. What about Sid and Nancy? She can't answer me. It annoys her.
I want you to leave.
Why?
You ask too many stupid questions.
Does that make you angry?
Yes.
What else makes you angry?
Sweeping generalizations, hypocrites, being blamed for something I didn't do, people who hurt children.
Were you hurt?
Why'd you jump to that?
I'm interested.
It's all in the files.
No, it's not, I say. You keep telling different stories to different people.
Maybe the truth changes.
Evie reaches for my arm and pushes up the sleeve, rolling it over my forearm to reveal a hummingbird hovering above a flower.
I'm going to get a tattoo,
she says. Anything in particular?
Something bold and unexpected. No butterflies or flowers or birds.
I like birds.
Mine is going to make a statement.
She traces the outline of the hummingbird.
Does it hurt?
Yes.
You're being honest.
Always.
That's a lie.
Do you ever hear voices, Evie?
No.
Are you anxious?
Not especially.
What are you most frightened of?
The people who want me dead.
Who are they?
Nameless men.
Do you have a gift?
No.
What about a curse? Evie lifts her head to look at me, her eyes like a mirror, reflecting my image back to me.
Yes.
Chapter 10.
The mortuary manager is a thin man, with a hook nose and nostrils like sinkholes that draw attention away from everything else on his face. I try not to stare at them as I show him my business card, asking to see Dr. Robert Ness.
"You're not police,"
he says, stating the obvious.
"I'm assisting in a murder investigation."
The manager eyes me suspiciously, as though my true mission is to steal body parts. A call is made, permission granted. I sign the visitor's book and look into the camera, letting my picture be captured, laminated, and hung around my neck. The mortuary is on the fourth floor of the Queen's Medical Centre, which has always seemed odd to me, because I feel like it belongs in the basement, closer to where we all finish. Dust to dust and all that. A trainee pathologist in green scrubs collects me from the reception area and leads me down a long corridor past post-mortem suites with stainless steel operating slabs and banks of halogen lights angled from above.
"You're late," says Ness,
peeling off his gloves and tossing them into a hazard waste bin. His dark hands are preternaturally pale from the talc that lingers on his fingers. He raises his arms, and an assistant unties his stained scrubs and takes the protective glasses from his forehead. Jodie's body is lying on the slab with cross stitches running from her torso to her pubic bone, showing where her organs were removed, weighed, and examined. The stitches are haphazard because Jodie has no need of a pretty scar. Under the bright lights, the whiteness of her flesh makes her look like a marble statue, with a tangle of blue veins lying just beneath the surface of her skin. Small for her age, with narrow hips and muscled legs from skating, her arms are scored by scratches, and her eye sockets look like pools of purple dye. Ness reaches up and switches off the microphone above his head and turns away, grimacing in pain when he puts weight on his right leg.
"Everything okay?"
"Gout," he mutters, as if no other explanation were needed.
"My doctor wants me to give up smoking, drinking, and eating rich foods. I think he's in cahoots with my wife. Maybe they're sleeping together."
"If she wanted you dead, she wouldn't care so much."
"True."
Another assistant approaches with a clipboard, needing a signature. Ness signs with a flourish.
"Tell the lab I want those bloods done by the morning."
"What did you find?" I ask.
"More questions than answers."
Stepping towards the bench, he picks up a white sheet, which he draws over Jodie's body, leaving only her face exposed. Tucking the sheet beneath her chin, he strokes her cheek like a father saying goodbye to his daughter. Finally, he moves away, as though not wanting to speak in front of her.
"The semen in her hair will give us a DNA signature. She had nothing internally but a small trace on her right thigh, along with evidence of a lubricant, which suggests a condom was used. I found no evidence of vaginal tearing or bruising, so the intercourse may have been consensual, at least at first."
"Why have sex with her and then ejaculate in her hair?"
"That's your area, not mine,"
says Ness, drinking from a bottle of water, not letting the plastic touch his lips. He wipes his mouth.
"Jodie had dirt under her fingernails, but no skin cells or obvious defence injuries. The scratches came from brambles and branches."
"You mentioned a blow to the head?"
"Some sort of blunt force trauma, which caused a hairline fracture of the parietal bone. But no internal bleeding."
Ness indicates the back of his skull.
"She might not have seen it coming. Most likely it knocked her unconscious or disorientated her. She had pond water in her lungs, which suggests she either fell or was pushed from the footbridge."
He tosses the empty water bottle in a bin. It rattles around the edge before it drops.
"Jodie didn't remove her own clothing. Her jeans were pulled down while she was lying on her back. She didn't get up again."
"How did she die?"
"That's a good question," says Ness, in no hurry to answer it.
He walks to a nearby bench and begins swapping his shoes.
"Have you ever heard of dry drowning?"
"No."
"When we inhale water into our lungs, we cut off oxygen to the body, which begins to shut down. Once we take a lungful of air, we cough up the water and usually begin breathing normally again. Everything is fine, except for when it's not. Ness can see my confusion. There is a condition called secondary or delayed drowning. With young children, it can happen in a matter of seconds, but the process typically takes longer in adults, hours or days. It tends to affect people who have damaged lungs or pulmonary illnesses. Jodie Sheehan suffered a bout of pneumonia 8 months ago and was hospitalized.
You're saying she drowned on dry land?
Possibly. Theoretically. I think she fell, or was thrown from the footbridge. Maybe the cold water brought her round. She crawled out, but was struggling to breathe because her diaphragm couldn't create the necessary respiratory movements. This made her sluggish. Slow. An easy target. Just so.
Ness slides his arms through the sleeves of his coat.
I can't tell you the exact cause of death, but the temperature on Monday night fell to below freezing. Jodie was cold and wet and barely conscious. She was always going to die, unless someone found her.
As I'm leaving, I pass the viewing suites in the waiting room. A lone figure is sitting on a plastic chair, bent forwards with his elbows on his knees and his eyes fixed on the floor. Even without seeing his face, I recognize Felix Sheehan.
We haven't met, I say. I'm Cyrus. I know who you are.
I'm sorry about your sister.
You didn't even know her.
That's true, but I'm still sorry for your loss. I notice a cigarette tucked behind his ear. He touches it occasionally before lacing his fingers in his hair. He's dressed in baggy jeans and a hooded sweatshirt that hangs so loosely on his lanky frame they could be draped on a wire coat hanger.
Have you been waiting long? I ask.
I want to see Jodie.
The words catch in his throat.
Can I ask why?
She's my sister. Isn't that enough?
The post-mortem has just finished. They'll be getting her ready.
I can picture them dressing Jodie in clean nightwear and brushing her hair. Afterwards, her body will be arranged in a supine position and covered in a white sheet with only her face and hands visible.
When did you last see her, Jodie?
At the fireworks.
What time did you leave?
More fucking questions!
He snarls, rattling off the same answers he gave to the police about visiting a nightclub and picking up a girl.
First I knew about Jodie was when Mum phoned me.
Did you get on well with your sister?
What sort of question is that?
I'm trying to learn more about her.
His eyes narrow, fixed on mine. Black. Hard.
You think I killed her?
No.
He can't hold my gaze. Relaxes. Shrugs.
We got on okay. I saw less of her when I moved out of home. She had her skating, I had my shit to do.
What do you do, Felix?
I buy and sell stuff. On eBay mostly. Somebody's trash is somebody's treasure, right?
Is there much money in that?
You'd be surprised. People throw all sorts of stuff away. I picked up a box of vinyl the other day and came across a mint copy of Sticky Fingers. Classic Rolling Stones, sealed, unopened, worth $3,000 at least.
He's watching me closely as he relates the story, as if gauging my reaction. Suddenly, he changes direction.
Was she raped?
She was sexually assaulted.
He swallows.
Did she suffer?
I don't know.
His fingers are opening and closing into fists, while his knee jiggles rhythmically. A nurse interrupts. Jodie's body is ready for viewing. Felix hesitates. His lower lip disappears as he bites down.
I've changed my mind. I don't want to see her.
He brushes past me, striding along the corridor, jabbing impatiently at the button on the lift, desperate to be outside, away from this place. It's like he's holding the sick in his mouth, looking for somewhere to vomit. As the lift doors close, his arms form a tent over his head, and his eyes shine like gemstones in a dark cave.
Chapter 11.
Silverdale Walk is a different place with the sun shining. Trees blaze orange and red, while others stand naked and grey, as if the artist ran out of paint on his palette before he could finish the landscape. Daylight has given context to the location, revealing landmarks and lines of sight. A thickly wooded ridge, a grass-covered coppice, the reed-fringed pond. It has taken me 12 minutes to walk from Jodie's house to the clearing where her body was found. A young police constable is standing guard at the scene, stopping bystanders from getting too close. A makeshift memorial has sprung up, a mound of flowers, cards and soft toys. Someone has made a sign saying, "Justice for Jodie." Remnants of crime scene tape flutter in the breeze. A team of police divers are packing up their gear, loading air tanks into wooden racks and hanging damp wetsuits over railings. The last of their number emerges from the water. Dripping in wrack and weeds, he looks like a prehistoric sea monster, crawling before he can walk. He stands and pulls off his mask, letting his respirator dangle against his chest. Clad in a wetsuit, his short, barrel-shaped body appears to be carved from granite or ebony. He swings his air tank to the ground and unhooks the harness. Ducking under the tape, I clamber down the embankment and join him beside the pond. The diver gives me a momentary glance and peels back the hood of his wetsuit, revealing a nest of shaggy hair.
"Dr. Haven," he says.
"Sergeant Thorndale." We shake hands damply, and I fight the urge to wipe mine on my thighs. Jack Thorndale is a former patient, a hostage negotiator, who came to see me after a 16-hour police siege went south. A disgruntled employee gunned down 4 of his workmates before turning the weapon on himself. Jack took the failure personally, and it almost cost him his marriage and his career. Eventually, he retrained as a police diver, saying he'd rather wade through filth than negotiate with madmen. "Any news?" I ask.
"The more we dive, the more shit we stir up. If she dropped her phone, it could have drifted downstream or be deep in the mud by now."
He points to a tarpaulin that is covered in a pile of rubbish retrieved from the pond. There are bicycles, a shopping trolley, broken concrete, metal pipes, half bricks and nondescript machinery parts, all caked in mud.
"Forensics are coming to take a look. Maybe we've stumbled upon a murder weapon, although I doubt it."
Someone yells from the van. His colleagues are cold and want to go home. Jack holds up a thumb.
"You working this one?"
"Yeah."
"I'd wish you luck, but you don't believe in it."
He grins. During our sessions, I talk to Jack about the difference between chance and luck. Chance is a random outcome in the real world, whereas luck is the value we place upon it when we label it good or bad. Whether the police find Jodie's phone isn't lucky or unlucky, it's the same chance event. Slinging the tank over his shoulder, Jack makes the embankment look easy as he joins his team. I walk to the footbridge and lean over the side. The brook, swollen by recent rain, is running freely and foaming as it enters the pond. In this quiet, lonely place, 2 people came together and 1 of them died. There must have been an interaction, however brief or violent. What did they say to each other? How did they spend their last moments together? What relationships and experiences shaped their personalities? No 2 people respond to the same situation in the same way. If Jodie met a stranger on the path on Monday night, would she automatically see him as being dangerous? Or would she smile and say hello? Would she start up a conversation or respond to a question? Would she turn her back? Would she run? Fight? Plead? Perhaps it was someone she knew. She could have been brought here, or lured by somebody she trusted. She was picked up in a car earlier in the evening. She had a 2nd mobile phone. This suggests a secret liaison, a boyfriend, or a casual hookup. At some point, Jodie was struck from behind, most likely without warning. She had turned her back. She either trusted this person, or she was trying to flee. Barely conscious, she fell, or was pushed off the bridge. The cold water shocked her awake. She swallowed some of it, almost drowned. Her attacker dragged her from the pond, or followed Jodie after she saved herself. She ran, disorientated by the darkness. Branches and brambles tore at her face and skin. She collapsed, close to death. Dying.
He undressed her hurriedly, clumsily. He unwrapped a condom.
No. It doesn't make sense.
Use of a prophylactic suggests forensic awareness. He wanted to conceal his identity. But why use a condom and then ejaculate into her hair? That's an act designed to humiliate or mark his territory or signify unconditional acceptance. Maybe they had sex and she denied him a second round. More likely, he couldn't maintain an erection and grew frustrated. Which means he's not experienced around women. He's a loner, socially inept. He wants a girlfriend, but nobody wants him. He knows this area, this place.
Some rapists panic and kill victims to protect their identity. Others take pleasure from abusing a victim at the moment of his or her death, or afterwards. The timing of the penetration reveals clues about them. I don't know the exact sequence of events, but this man and his corrupt lust sacrificed a human life for an orgasm. Afterwards, he left her to die, or he watched her take her last breath. He covered her body with branches, trying to hide what he'd done. He went home, showered, changed his clothes, tried to forget. But he won't stop thinking about this. Part of him will be horrified, but another voice will tell him that she deserved it, that she led him on, that she was like all the other women who ignored him, belittled him, laughed at him. My knees are hurting. I've been squatting on my haunches for too long. I straighten, drinking in the cold air, and begin to move away from the footbridge, walking in a widening circle, feeling the softness of the ground beneath my feet. Everywhere I see signs of the police search, evidence markers, broken twigs, boot prints. But I'm not looking for the same things they were. A psychologist views a crime scene differently from a detective. Police search for physical clues and witnesses. I look at the overall picture and the salience of certain landmarks and features. Where are the obstacles and boundaries that alter behaviour? How quickly does someone disappear from sight? How far can I see in each direction? What are the vantage points and the shortcuts? Ahead of me, I glimpse something straight-edged through the trees, embowered by ferns. It's an old groundkeeper's cottage, or hunting lodge, which has fallen into disrepair. Grey with age, the walls are streaked with rust from the downpipes, and creepers have twisted around the spindlewood railings that fence in a small front veranda. The path is overgrown, but not unused. There are muddy boot prints and torn cobwebs. The police must have searched here yesterday. Stepping inside the derelict cottage, I take a moment to let my eyes adjust to the darkness. The wooden floorboards are splintery with age and stained by innumerable spills and leakages. Rubbish is strewn across the floor, and the walls are covered in graffiti, none artistic, some of it obscene, or as harmless as initials inside a heart. An old mattress yellowing with age has been positioned in front of a hearth, which is full of crushed beer cans, blackened by a recent fire. A half-drunk bottle of apple cider is within reach. Two more empties are nearby. I move to the next room, a kitchen that reeks of damp and decay. Rubbish floats in an ankle-deep puddle, crisp packets and condom wrappers. Someone has ripped out the copper pipes, no doubt for scrap metal. The final room, most likely a bedroom, has a roof that has partially collapsed, giving me a glimpse of blue sky and the tops of trees. I understand instinctively where I am, not the original purpose of the building, but what it has become. A place where youngsters can avoid the gaze of adults, where they break up, make up, hang out and make out, where they experiment with alcohol, drugs and sex. Did Jodie ever come here? Did this place mean something to her, or her killer? The police have searched the cottage, but I doubt if any of them recognise the likely salience. Detectives don't understand the ley lines that teenagers use to navigate their world. The shortcuts, the meeting places, the secret language. Later, I call Lenny from a phone box opposite the school. It goes to her voicemail. The killer is in his late teens or twenties, physically strong but not overly intelligent. He's local. This is his territory. He knows the area. He knows the footpath and maybe the cottage, Look for someone who's been arrested or questioned for lesser offences, like exposing himself to women or stealing their underwear. I don't think he planned the rape or the murder. It was too disorganised. But he possibly knew Jodie or was aware of her, and she may have played a part in his sexual fantasies. He's going to feel bad about what he's done. Ashamed. This is the first time for him. His first murder. He'll be following the police investigation closely, frightened and appalled, but also fascinated, which means he could return to the scene as an onlooker or bystander. Look for his face in the crowd. He's somewhere close by, watching.
Chapter 12. Angel Face.
I hear a knock.
Are you decent?
Asks Davina. She's a big woman with coloured beads woven into her dreadlocks that tumble to her shoulders, curling at the ends like pig's tails. She leans on the frame, thrusting out one hip.
You have a visitor?
Who?
Dr. Haven?
I feel a surge of excitement. Tossing aside my magazine, I swing my legs off the bed and go to the mirror, touching my hair and brushing my fingertips along my eyebrows. I reach for my makeup bag.
He's not your boyfriend,
Davina chuckles. She's still standing in the doorway. I want to slap her for being a bitch.
Shall I tell him you're coming? I could throw rose petals in your path. Fuck off. That's a red card.
I pull the hood of my sweatshirt over my hair and follow Davina down the hallway, less certain than before. Normally I don't care about shrinks and social workers. I've dealt with so many. But this one unsettled me the last time. It was nothing he did or said. He didn't ask about my family or my real name or where I came from or what happened to me as a child. Instead, he seemed to hold up a mirror to me, wanting me to look. Entering the dining room, I find him sitting at a table nursing a cup of tea. He stands and bows in an old-fashioned way, like he's Prince Charles, which makes me smirk. I take a moment to decide where I should sit. Opposite is best, so I can see his face. Cyrus is smiling. He looks tired, like someone is blowing air into his eyes, making him blink. Why are you smiling? I ask, guardedly.
I'm pleased to see you.
I make a scoffing sound and study his face, but cannot find a lie.
I told you I'd come back. How have you been?
I shrug. Cyrus picks a chocolate finger biscuit and nibbles one end. That's not how you should eat them, I say. He looks at the biscuit. You have to bite off both ends. Then you can use it like a straw.
In my tea?
Exactly. Cyrus bends his head and sucks tea through the biscuit. Eat it before it gets too soggy, I say. He stuffs the biscuit into his mouth and chews, showing his chocolate-stained teeth.
That's really good.
I don't think you should try it at the Ritz.
Have you ever been to the Ritz?
Oh, all the time, I say, putting on my posh voice. I do so love their high tea, the scones and clotted cream and strawberry jam. Although one doesn't understand the point of cucumber sandwiches, they taste of nothing, don't you think?
Do you lie a lot, Evie?
What do you consider a lot?
Enough for people to think you're a liar.
I've been called worse. I feel my jaw tighten. I don't want Cyrus to be like the others. So sometimes I lie. Is that so weird? You'd lie as well if you were stuck in here. You'd make up stories, amuse yourself.
What do you lie about?
Random stuff. I don't even know why I do it half the time. It's automatic, like sneezing. Sometimes I hear myself say something and I think, that's not even remotely true, not even fucking close. But I still keep going. The other day I told this new girl that my father is a treasure hunter, looking for a Spanish galleon that sank in the Bermuda Triangle. I told Cordelia that I won a scholarship to a cheerleading school in California, but had to turn it down because I'm on a no-fly list as a suspected terrorist. Stupid cow, believe me. Cyrus laughs. He has a nice smile. It makes his eyes go crinkly at the sides. You want to play cards? I ask, taking a deck from the pocket of my hoodie.
Okay.
Poker, Texas Hold'em, is that all right? I divide, bridge and flip the deck, overlapping the edges and sliding the cards together. I do it twice more before racking the deck loudly against the table. With a flick of my fingers, I deal, sending cards spinning across the formica. I peel up the corners and check the hole cards. Cyrus takes longer. He doesn't play cards very often. I can tell from how he arranges them in his hand. What are we going to bet? I ask.
I don't think we should gamble.
It's poker. We have to bet.
Not money.
How about we gamble for questions?